Welcome everyone to What the Force, and welcome to another episode of Once Upon a Time in the Outer Rim. We are covering the episode 5 of The Mandalorian, chapter 5, The Gunslinger. And with me to cover this episode is my good friend, Alex Kane.
Hey, what's up, everybody?
This episode is where, I don't know, a lot happened in this episode, and we're going to get into it. And it's actually really fascinating, and it makes me giggle. So I hope that you guys could, put up with me laughing, half the time. This show, Once Upon a Time in the Outer Rim, covers, Star Wars from a connotative, metatextual, mythic, genre-specific lens. And, it's a lot of fun, and we've been having a lot of fun with it. I can't believe that we're almost halfway done with this season. But I'm really looking forward to seeing how it goes and how it ends. And if you want to keep up to date with this show or any of our other What the Force shows, make sure to subscribe on your podcast app of choice or on YouTube to keep up to date. Of course, we're going to be talking about spoilers because this is a steep dive into the show. So, Alex, what's the recap for the episode?
Okay. In this episode, written and directed by Dave Filoni, the Mandalorian takes a surprise detour to Luke Skywalker's home planet of Tatooine. After a near-fatal dogfight in outer space, the Mandalorian and his adopted child, still Baby Yoda until further notice, make an emergency pit stop at Mos Eisley, the hive of scum and villainy where filmgoers first met Han Solo in Star Wars A New Hope. The settlement looks a little different from how audiences might remember it. Stormtrooper helmets decorate the streets on spikes, symbolic of the Outer Rim's reclamation from the evil Galactic Empire. A droid now tends the bar at the famous Mos Eisley Cantina, and we glimpse mostly all new patrons nursing drinks where Luke and old Ben once bargained for passage to the Alderaan system. We meet several interesting new characters in this episode, the first of whom is a mechanic named Peli Motto, played by Amy Sedaris. Motto runs Docking Bay 35, which is a close match for Docking Bay 94 from A New Hope, and she's got the hair and outfit to pass for Sigourney Weaver's first turn as Ellen Ripley in Ridley Scott's Alien. The character is aided by a crew of pit droids like the ones we met in The Phantom Menace. While Mando wanders into town in search of work, Baby Yoda's left alone aboard the Razor Crest. But when the tiny child awakens, he descends the gangplank and is discovered by Motto and her droid crew, who decide to play babysitter until the Mandalorian returns, for an extra fee, naturally. Inside the cantina, Mando catches the eye of a young amateur bounty hunter who is looking to earn his place within the guild, Toro Calican. The two team up to catch a dangerous mercenary called Fennec Shand and head out into the Dune Sea on a pair of swoop bikes. The two negotiate with Tusken Raiders, another callback to the original Star Wars, fall into a trap, and spend a long night keeping watch, knowing they're being hunted by Shand, who's eyeing them through the sight of a long-range blaster rifle. There are some fun western-style brawls and shootouts, but the real excitement of this episode comes from the unexpected double-cross that happens when Mando leaves Toro and Shand alone together in the desert. After Shand tries to convince the young newbie of her usefulness, and the fortune that awaits him if he can bring Mando and Baby Yoda into the guild, whom he betrayed in Episode 3, Toro shoots Shand and leaves her for dead. When the Mandalorian returns to retrieve his ship, Toro's waiting for him in the hangar, blaster in one hand and Baby Yoda in the other. Mando has no choice but to kill the ambitious young gunslinger. Out on the Dune Sea, meanwhile, spurs jingle as a dark figure approaches the body of Fennec Shand and kneels down beside her.
Oh my. We're going to talk about this episode. But first, general thoughts. And I'm going to go first, which is kind of rare, because the first thing that struck me after watching this episode, and I had to actually watch it fairly late in the day. I didn't get an opportunity to really watch it, either in the middle of the night, because that's when it comes out, or early morning, which I normally try to do before I kind of see any spoilers. And the general reaction on the internet was one of general displeasure. And it was absolutely fascinating to watch. A lot of people didn't really enjoy this episode very much, or they felt like it was very odd. And I know why, I think. And this is pure, absolute speculation, but I'm going to go through my reasoning as far as why I think it is this way. This episode was ghostwritten by George Lucas. And I'm going to go into that. So George has a particular style, and you can just go back to the prequels or some of the Clone Wars episodes, especially in first season, as far as what his writing style is. His writing style is very, very unsubtle dialogue. It's very straight to the point, and we experience that a lot compared to, say, other aspects throughout the season. The characters say what they mean, they do what they say, they say exactly what they're going to do. It's very straight to the point. And my friend Blind Man Baldwin, Matt, actually helped me kind of compile this together, like as far as his characteristics, because it's very, very important that you kind of like see it. There's always a commitment to humor, especially physical comedy. It always has to feel like a fun adventure. There's always an adventure when George is writing. There's always like cars or racing or some sort of high speed motor escapade where they're showing off a little bit. There's always parent relationship, child situation. There's always, always, always some sort of like tough guy type situation where he has to prove who he really is. And then he kind of gets his comeuppance a little bit. These are very, very George-esque things. And we have all of that in this episode, including pit droids and, you know, the return to Tatooine and then the racing of the motorbikes, which feels very much like muscle cars in some ways, like the young kid speeds forward. And so the old Mandalorian has to like speed past him. And like, it's very specific to like a George psyche. So George Lucas. Additionally, we have nonstop physical comedy. We have, especially with our mechanic, Pelly, she has physical comedy with her droids. Her droids are like Larry, Curly, and Moe. You know, they remind me exactly of the Phantom Menace droids. And it's like George was like pulled out of the closet. He wrote this with Dave, and Dave decided to change nothing. Maybe it was from a conversation, but it is extremely George Lucas in its presentation. And especially when we get into kind of some of the more mythic aspects, which we will for sure get into, they don't feel the same as, say, some of the storytelling that we've received in the last four episodes that were written by Jon Favreau, nor do they feel like Dave Filoni's writing. So we know Dave Filoni has written several episodes of Rebels, some of like kind of given the story for the Resistance episodes, but several specific episodes of Rebels, including World Between Worlds, Twilight of the Apprentice, the second one he's given credit for, Ghosts of Geonosis 1 and 2, Flight of the Defender, Doom, Wolves at the Door, World Between Worlds, Family Reunion, and kind of all of these very emotionally driven episodes, he tends to like write from that perspective. This episode felt like a kid adventure. Which is so George. It is so George, and I love it so much because it felt like he was in the room. Like, to me, it felt like George Lucas. I also want to call out one thing, which is when John was writing the story, almost none of the characters had names. We had to like turn on the closed captioning to like see the names, or we had to like wait to the end to be like, who is that? Because nobody knew the names. Like, we didn't know what like Quill's name was or anything. Every person said their name, which is a very George Lucas thing. He, like, as an example, this is like, you know, we have like Jar Jar Binks always says like everybody's names, but like Obi-Wan walks into the diner and he's like, Dax, and you know, Dax is like, Obi-Wan, like they he says people's names in his writing. It is just a very Georgian thing to do. Lucas, I love you so much. Thank you. Thank you for creating Star Wars. But yeah, what do you think of that? Like, how George Lucas this feels?
Yeah, I think that Toro, the sort of young, like in over his head bounty hunter or would be bounty hunter, you know, he's sort of the archetypal Lucas antihero. I mean, I mean, Lucas comes from this sort of renegade counterculture filmmaking movement, right? Mm-hmm. It started with things like Easy Rider, for example, which is about a couple of motorcycles out in the desert. Just saying, you know, he comes from that school of thought that like a story can be minimalistic and still have like enormous power, and you know, and like. You know, he comes from that Leone Kurosawa school where, mm-hmm. you know, if you draw the characters, you know, larger than life, you can make them feel mythic, you know, the good, the bad, and the ugly, you know, those characters are sort of, you know.
Yeah, like he tends sort of Star to make Wars his weight. Characters more caricatures. Like he tends...
Cartoony.
Yeah, mm-hmm. and cartoony. And the mechanic was on the cartoony side.
Yeah.
I would say the only character that kind of maybe wasn't cartoony in this was the Mandalorian. Like, yep. even Baby Yoda had some cartoony moments a lot. And, like, the droids, the mechanic, the young kid who was, you know, had his character all wrapped around him. Even the experience in the cantina was very cartoony.
Yeah.
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 The droids playing poker with the mechanic. Like, mm-hmm. that is so George Lucas.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Like, George has his own sort of comic book logic for everything. If it's like fun and playful and catches your eye, then it's right. Right. As long mm-hmm. as it, as long as like the production design is sort of this, you know, nitty gritty feel and feels Star Wars, feels Macquarie or Doug Chang or what have you. Yeah, he likes to have it dialed up to 11, you know.
Yeah.
Dexter Jetster and Jar Jar Binks. I mean, that's George. The pit droids. I think the pit droids were the first thing I thought of when you started told me your George theory. But yeah, I mean, the character who sort of plays pre-car crash Lucas, for lack of a better term, in American Graffiti, with mm-hmm. the hot rodder character, the sort of like reckless, bitter, very like kind of, you know, flexing his muscles and sort of doing his whole peacocking masculinity thing with the drag racing and the cruising the strip. And, you know, that whole thing is very much, you know, what Toro is in this. You know, he's not, yeah, you know, he's got a big opinion of himself that, ultimately winds up getting him killed, right? Like, because he just kind of, he sort of buys the lie that, you know, you can kind of have it all and just get away with it. And, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. I have a lot of thoughts on that character too, but, so you agree, like, this was a very George Lucas-y episode, right?
Oh, of course. Yeah, yeah. Yeah. Once you said that, it really made sense, because it is incredibly different. And mm-hmm. it's no surprise to me that it's divisive in the way that it has been, where people are like, oh, this is like kind of different. You know, this is a sharp turn from the Sanctuary, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. And even like the three episodes before that, like, felt very, I don't know, cohesive in some ways. And this one almost felt like purposefully, like, if you love Star Wars, you have to love all of Star Wars. And I'm going to get into that later as well, because, yeah. Oh my gosh, there's so much metatextual stuff going on in this episode, and I love it all. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. We did talk a little bit about Pele. I did want to bring up, like, where we're at with our Mandalorian and talk a little bit about characters. I know we haven't really done that much, like, focused on the characters that are brought in, but our Mandalorian made Baby Yoda like a little crib to, like, hang out in the cockpit. And, like,
yeah.
Our Mandalorian knows how to swaddle the baby so that he can go down for naps / bedtime. Like, swaddling is not easy. Like, as
no,
did you learn how to swaddle your baby?
Yeah, yeah. It's you know, you have to find a little bit of mastery to do it properly and not have it fall apart.
Their arms in, do you keep their arms out? Obviously, this Baby Yoda is past the swaddling and kicks right out. Obviously, mm-hmm. Baby Yoda needs a sleep sack.
Oh, sure.
Like a zip with, like, a, you know, like the little lag, like, clip. Yeah, mm-hmm. So that doesn't kick off his blankets. Mando's like trying. He's like, he's caring for baby. He mm-hmm. he knows, you know, what baby needs. He's trying to protect baby to the best of his ability, but he still leaves the baby alone in the ship.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And actually, like, to me, this was the most, like, when Pele finds the baby and then he's like, oh, shoot, I left the baby alone in the ship. What did I think was going to happen? And and she's like, I'm holding this baby. I'm taking care of this baby. He's like, thanks. Like, I heard that in his voice.
he's like, give it to me now. He, like, freaks out right at first. But then immediately she's like, no, like, we've been taking care of it. And
like, the baby was having a nap on me. Like, yeah. You're okay.
Yeah, they were napping together. I think she was napping a little bit too, right?
Mm-hmm.
They both were.
Like, how was she fixing the ship if she didn't use droids? That's a different question. Well, she was having a nap holding the baby.
Yeah.
That was not a thing. She used droids. She lied to him about that.
Oh, yeah. Yep. I think you're right about that one.
Was there anything else from The Mandalorian that you saw that was really interesting for him?
I mean, I know that we kind of speculated before that his arc would involve, like, you know, the sort of road of trials and messing up. And we, like, we haven't really got to that too much yet. He consistently tries to kind of do the right thing. You know, he was going to, like, leave him on, you know, the sanctuary planet with, you know, Omera and those people. You know, his reasons for not doing that were ultimately, like, you know,
the best reasons.
Selfless. And he's doing a lot of good for the child and making sure that he's protected, you know. I mean, like, leaving him on the ship, you know, was like sort of a head scratcher type thing where it's like, oh, what were you thinking? But I mean, you know, he's doing much better than we kind of thought he might be by this point, I think.
As a parent, like, sometimes you're like, I left the kid up for a nap and he's been crying for a while and I was down in the basement for a minute and I didn't realize, like, these things happen and they just did it like an exaggerated version of it. It was really cool to see. I have one thing that I'm going to bring up in the mythic section, but he's already learned lessons that he is carrying forward from his previous sort of growth and opportunities. So I'm going to bring that up later on. Baby Yoda is advancing from a child perspective because getting out of swaddling is a big thing, walking around, getting into trouble. But also Baby Yoda has started to verbalize more and he sounds kind of like a duck. Like, he kind of quacked near the end. It was kind of cute, but, like, you know, trying to produce sounds. So, I mean, my theory about him maybe saying the first word, I think we're going to get in this season. Like, he's advancing from a baby perspective. Yeah. He's growing, our little boy.
Yeah, we got, like, a pretty decent look at the ship and the sort of layout of the interior in, like, the very first episode when the sort of fish man was wandering around trying to escape. And it's kind of, you know, it's like a, I think there's even two levels to it, maybe, right? Like, there might be, you know, so Baby Yoda might have had to, like, climb down. It's not really clear, but, you know, I mean, he kind of had,
like,
to know the layout.
Like a screaming noise or something.
Oh, so you think he might have fallen and that was a little off-screen humor?
I don't know. They tried to make it sound like a monster, and I think that plays into some of the genre stuff we're going to talk about with Pelly in a moment. Okay. But they made him sound like a monster, and then this little baby comes out. Like, yeah, so.
Oh, yeah, they're all, like, on the defensive, like, what's in there? What's he got on board? Yeah, that's true.
Yeah. Yeah, and then we have Toro, who, I don't know if you noticed this, but he's totally a rich kid.
Sure. Yeah.
Yeah. He had no need for money. He didn't want the reward. He was carrying around a wad of money of different types of credits, like a whole mix. He had that gold earring and he was playing with, like, a specialty coin when we introduced him. And all of his clothes were, like, immaculate. It was compared to, like, how we met the Mandalorian and, like, what he was wearing. This is very purposeful to show that this is a guy who is probably from money, probably very rich, actually probably has a family. But he seems to be wanting to be a bounty hunter to, like, have power and glory.
Very George thing, right? Like, George's dad was, like, a rich businessman and he, you know, he didn't want to run that business, but he did want to have, like, success and freedom and kind of, you know, rebellious streak.
Yeah, like, he wanted to go and make a name for himself doing his own thing that he loved and he enjoyed. And that was very much what we're getting from Toro.
Yep.
Yeah. And then we also had Fennec Shand, who a lot of people pointed out when her name came out kind of in the intro articles, like Fennec as in Fennec Fox.
Okay.
And, you know, like, basically she's like a mercenary who is very feared. And like, even the Mandalorian's like, no way. You're funny. No. So he's like, he's smart enough to know, like, this wouldn't be an easy get.
Mm-hmm.
But he decides to help him anyways, because the money is going to be enough, and to help out Toro to capture Fennec. And Ming-Na Wen, you know, who we know, of course, from Mulan and from Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., who is Agent May. And she is just awesome. She is always awesome in everything she does. And we get a very good kind of play of her, you know, her character in a moment, which we're going to talk about in a little bit. But what did you think of Fennec?
I mean, I loved the sort of the conversation, the kind of like, you know, I'll seduce you with your own sort of vanity and naivete, mm-hmm. and, you know, that sort of almost like a femme fatale kind of trope, right? Where, you know, she's, you know, she could just shoot him, you know, she could like strangle him with the handcuffs or something. But instead she thinks that almost in sort of like a Thrawn kind of thing where she, you know, I can use this kid, right? Like I can mm-hmm. control him with his weaknesses. I can pinpoint what, you know, what I can say to get him to, you know, let me free and deal with my problems for me, you know, kind of like the pit droids are doing the repairs for, you know, Motto maybe. I liked that sort of, you know,
like it was very
intellectual side of her.
It, you know, it very much aligned to the mythological idea of Fennec, a fox, as a trickster, you know, like using her wits over her other aspects. Like she was certainly a skilled fighter. She certainly is a sharpshooter. She certainly probably could have wrestled him to the ground and choked her with his thigh, like choked him with her thighs. Like she could have like done one of the Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. moves to get him, you know, but instead she's like, you know, maybe I can get something out of this. Maybe I could get part of that Beskar too. Also, mm-hmm. like to that femme fatale aspect, many foxes from a mythological perspective actually have that trickster woman thing. So sometimes fox spirits are women specifically in mythology, and like especially the concept of a vixen is a female fox, right? So it's like is built into our mythological DNA as a culture.
Yeah. And in like Norse mythology you have Loki, and at least the way that some of those myths are interpreted, you know, in like the modern, you know, the Neil Gaiman Norse mythology book and that kind of thing, where the way he's characterized is almost being more traditionally feminine and like sort of like womanly in his sort of desires and amusements than like even like the Norse gods who happen to be women, you know, like the sort of,
yeah,
you know, there's this like idea in Norse mythology that Thor and Odin and all these characters, you know, Frigga, like there's sort of a jock element to them, you know, they're not very like complicated beings, you know, they kind of want you know, they want war and excitement and food and you know, other things. And Loki's like, I just thought that would be hilarious, you know. You know, I just thought that would be funny. You know, I'm gonna trick this frost giant or these dwarves into, you know, doing this crazy thing for my amusement. And Loki is very, you know, he's like complex you know, manipulative, you know, is the word really. The whole there's the trickster element. Where is Thrawn a trickster? No, but she does have sort of like both of those characteristics, like kind of a Loki meets Thrawn.
Yeah, like she uses her brain over brawn, even though she's got other skills, right? She also, like heading into kind of our genre areas, she also fulfilled kind of this like Western sniper or sharpshooter or archer type trope. But like this episode from a genre perspective felt more like an action adventure / George American Graffiti situation than it ever felt like a Western, you know?
Yeah. I mean, even the sort of like the gag where there's like a trap, there's a dead body with like a tracking fob. And, you know, when they go to investigate the body, that's when she sort of, that's a totally George thing from like, you know, Return of the Jedi, you know, Chewie thinking with his stomach, or, you know, Indiana Jones, or, you know, there's like a lot of examples of, you know, I think Luke and the Tuskens and some of that stuff, you know, there's this, you know, you investigate the thing that looks like, oh, we're safe because it's just a dead body. And, you know,
it turns out to be nods or there's some sort of trap. Yeah. And then, you know, you brought up during the recap, Peli and, the Ripley parallel.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, Peli Motto has the big 1979, you know, hair. She's got sort of that mechanics jumpsuit, you know, that the Nostromo crew wears, you know, Ash and Ripley and you know, all those characters from the original Alien film have that kind of, you know, sort of grease monkey outfit, you know, very functional, not like a lot of the Star Wars outfits, you know. I think that just simple things like the little triangle patch, you know, that sort of fits with the Weyland Yutani logo that, you know, Ripley and those crew members wear. And of course, there's this idea that, you know, she's interacting with Baby Yoda. And so she's got this monster emerging into her kind of domain, and she's got a, you know.
Well, and like you got that roar, right? You got that you know, kind of monster-y sound. And I thought that was so weird. I was like, why would Baby Yoda make that noise? But it was for that parallel to Alien. And the entire purpose of this parallel is to call attention to her not being Ripley.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, she's very instinctively nurturing and motherly and immediately wants to be, you know, the nurse, right?
Yeah. Like, pick up that baby and make sure. No, go find this baby bones. Also, side note, what is with feeding Baby Yoda bone broth and bones?
Yeah, she specifically says something with bones. Yeah, that's odd. That's interesting.
Isn't it weird? So it makes me think of the Ultimate Jedi song by the Mountain Goats.
Okay, interesting.
The Ultimate Jedi eats all the other Jedi and their bones.
Amazing.
So yeah, listen to that song if you've never listened to it. He wrote it like on a favor, or kind of like in homage to Rian Johnson.
Huh.
Writing The Last Jedi, and he like he let out, like, Rian Johnson announced the name the Last Jedi, and the lead singer of the Mountain Goats is like, oh darn it, I missed my opportunity to suggest the Ultimate Jedi who wastes all the other Jedi and eats their bones
as episode 8's title.
As episode 8's title, Jedi. Yes, and then he wrote a song about it.
Amazing.
It's amazing. And me and Ali Nasser, who's one of the lead singers of Miss This Band, we actually did an episode on it because it's so weird. It's awesome and weird and cool and like weird, but like kind of like spiritual and metaphorical. It's just, it's really interesting. But like, what's with feeding Baby Yoda bones and not like milk? Like, that's very weird, isn't it?
It's a very like Campbellian idea of like life eats death to create life, and then like there's this, you know, the whole snake, the serpent, right? Also there's the fact that George Lucas loves parody and spoofs and comedy. Like, he, you know, I've got the Mad Magazine like best of anthology.
I love how
forward.
We're just like, George wrote this. Yeah. With it.
Given our you know, our proven thesis, you know.
Either it is the best, like, homage that Dave Filoni has ever done to George Lucas, or George Lucas wrote this.
Yeah. Like, it wouldn't surprise me. The song that you just told me about that I was completely unaware of, it would not surprise me in the slightest if George Lucas knows about that, as a fan of that, or Filoni, perhaps. But that's a very George thing to, I mean, the Blu-ray box set that came out in 2011, there's a whole disc devoted to parodies of Star Wars, and it's one of my favorite things in the world, that disc that's just like, let's make fun of Star Wars, and George Lucas said, let's put that in the box set. I mean, you know, he's a goofy guy. He's got a sense of humor. So to have this weird sort of inverse alien where like, oh no, the alien's coming out of the ship.
And no, it's not actually. And it was almost like he was trying to say Star Wars is not sci-fi.
Yeah. And there's that too.
Yeah.
There's a lot
like
of,
it was, it's about family. It's about nurturing. It's about improving yourself through understanding who your inner child is. And the same thing happens to Pele that happened to the Mandalorian. As soon as she's like got the baby in her hands, like, the inner child is nurtured and is successfully grows because of the experience.
Yeah. And George is not like a self unaware person. Like he knows that his life story mirrors that of Anakin Skywalker and Darth Vader. And the, you know, he's aware of this stuff and he's talked about
it. And like Luke Skywalker is literally Lucas Skywalker.
Yeah, yeah.
Like it's all self-insert fiction here that we're talking about. But this episode was the first self-referential episode. Can I talk about that for a moment? So
sure, sure.
Into the George Lucas theory we continue. So the first scene when Mando is fighting that like bounty hunter that's going after him, the bounty hunter's like, I can bring you in warm or I can bring you in cold. It's your choice. Mm-hmm. And then the bounty hunter kills him and is like, that's my line. Yeah. That is so George Lucas.
That's meta drama. It's meta drama.
It's meta. It's, and it's like
Shakespearean.
That repetitive use of a line is so George because like, I have a bad feeling about this.
Mm-hmm.
Like using that self-referential thing is like so George. It is so George. I keep on saying that and I'm going to try to stop. But wow.
Yeah. George is a guy who cares about music and poetry and rhyme and repetition and chorus and these things. Like, you know, he's a very kind of experimental, you know, poetically minded, you know, he's sort of making silent films, right? Like The Phantom Menace is sort of a silent film that happens to have conversation at the dinner table.
The music was very powerful in this.
Yeah, definitely it was. And also just like the idea that when in writing too, when you say things like this is the way and, you know, I can bring you in hot and bring you in cold, you know, the callback to the first episode, you know, that would be like that repetition. That's like a lyrical device, right? That's like a chorus. I don't know. That strikes me as a Lucas thing.
Yeah. Like it's, you get the feeling that this is continuing on. This episode also, so I want to compare like structurally and like a little bit into the mythic storytelling that we've gotten so far from Jon Favreau. It has been very on the surface symbolic. This symbolism that we're about to get into is less on the surface and more calls to more complex mythologies that maybe not everybody would have picked up on. And so that to me is Dave Filoni, probably very George Lucas in origin, because it's not obvious. This stuff is not going to be obvious to a lot of people. And it's still happening because it is. It's in the text. It's there and it's happening. We talked about kind of the Desert Fox temptation. I'm going to dig into that just a little bit more specifically because it is incredibly how Dave Filoni and George Lucas talk about Star Wars. But first I wanted to talk about the trip into the desert where our young hero and our old mentor,
yeah,
which is so, it's so George.
Yep.
We have Luke Skywalker and Obi-Wan Kenobi basically going off into the desert on an adventure to go and do something where they need something out of this. And the Mandalorian, the old mentor, is taking his time to actually teach the young buck something. Deserts are really important from a mythological perspective. They're like a trial in and of itself. Think about Jesus going into the desert for 40 days. Think about, you know, many of the fox legends also happen in a desert. So it's really interesting from that perspective. But essentially, when you enter a desert, it is like the underworld of a hero's journey. It is a version of the underworld because you are in a dead zone. There, nothing grows. I mean, things grow, but it is considered to be a dead a dead world, a dead planet, Tatooine is. But Tatooine is like the Holy Land from a Star Wars mythology perspective. This is the place and like birth location of Anakin Skywalker and Luke Skywalker. Like, it is, this planet is important. So when you go into a desert, you either meet God, yourself, or the devil, or all three.
Mm-hmm.
And when they run across the Tusken Raiders, the sand people, originally Toro wants to kill them. He's like, why don't we just like shoot them? And he's like, the Mandalorian is like, no, we need to talk to them. We need to pass their land. And then he goes and talks to them and he uses sign language, which was very interesting. What did you think of that?
The sign language. Yeah, I don't know. That sort of comes out of nowhere, but it fits with this idea that, you know, Luke Skywalker speaks droid, you know, Han Solo happens to know, you know, Shrywook or whatever, you know, the Chewbacca's language. There's, you know, there's this idea that in Star Wars, we respect the other, right? I mean, there's othering that happens, and, you know, us and them stuff, of course. But like, there's this idea that, you know, language is, just because basic is the trade language doesn't mean that we can't, you know, it's sort of a rare thing to find people who are like trilingual or better, you know, in like our current society. You know, people, I know people who do learn languages as a hobby. I think they have, you know, it's a lot of effort and it's costly to do that. You know, it's like a big effort, you know, it's respectful, I think, you know, this idea that they're in the domain of the sand people, you know, they literally call them sand people. So to try to speak their language is, you know, it's an incredible sign of respect instead of,
Yeah. Yeah. He was deeply respectful of the sand people. He understood that when he saw them off in the distance, that they would come up from behind him, which is exactly what happens to Luke.
Yeah.
In A New Hope.
Mm-hmm.
And okay. So there's so many things happening in this scene and it makes me so happy. Okay, so the lead up to it, the last time that we saw somebody specifically on a swoop bike like that looks exactly like Anakin's. Mm-hmm. Just before he goes and is heading towards another woman, his mother, to try and rescue her. And he goes into the confrontation with the sand people and he ends up like murdering all of them, right? Very bad stuff. Whew. Okay, next time we see sand people in the shows, in the movies, Luke is like, hey, look, they're off to the west. I see sand people, but I don't see, or I see banthas, I don't see any sand people. And then they sneak up behind him or in front of him and you go,
yeah. But,
okay, so this is like a combination of those two moments.
Yeah.
And they sneak up and they scare the young kid, but they don't scare him. And then he communicates with them. And what does he do? Instead of like killing them or, you know, fighting them off and getting hurt or whatever, he's like, let's negotiate. Let's have a peaceful solution to this, which is actually something that he had learned from his experience with the egg and the Jawas, which was a parallel to Tatooine in general. So like literally he learned in a Tatooine-like environment all of the things that he would need to take with him to speak with the sand people and do better next time. This is ring theory in the show, but it also parallels the larger ring story. I need a moment.
You know, the Jawas are, they're sort of on Arvala 7, sort of making their way, just as they did on Tatooine in the original film. And then, you know, his solution to them is to intimidate and shoot fire in their faces to try to get what he wants, you know, the first time around. And so when he winds up in the sort of desert of all deserts in Star Wars, Tatooine, you know, then
he's already, you know, grown.
He's a wiser. Yeah. Yeah. He's like,
and he's trying to teach that to Toro. He's trying to teach that like, no, like, and okay. So this from a meta perspective. Okay, I've got the line. He's like, give me your biops or whatever, like the binoculars, the Star Wars version of binoculars. And he's like, but these are new. And he's like, yes, but we have to pass through their land. This is us as new fans, new enjoying the new materials, the new story of Star Wars, must understand and respect the past and pay our homage, our respects, and like love all of Star Wars. Because like the old Star Wars is still Star Wars. And like we have to understand that that's also part of Star Wars. You don't necessarily have to pay attention to it all the time, but you have to understand that it's part of it and you can't hate it.
Yeah.
It teaches us something.
It's interesting. Like Anakin goes off into the desert in Attack of the Clones to save a life and to sort of be a hero. And he ends up sort of finding the devil, as you put it. Mm-hmm. And this time they're going off to kind of... potentially take a life. But, you know, it occurs to me because of the way that, you know, I try to think when I'm talking to you about this stuff is, you know, it's almost like we're getting a version of Vader, Anakin Skywalker, rather, probably, as the father of Luke Skywalker, the father-son relationship they never had.
Yeah. Oh my God, you got it.
They never had, right? They never had it.
I literally was going to say that. I'm so amazing. Happy.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Like you have the young son and it's like telling us what should have happened. Vader should have been there for his son to teach him about sand people and to tell him, you know, Anakin probably knew how to negotiate with sand people. He never got captured, but Luke was never with his father to have him teach him those lessons. We had a version of the story this way.
Yeah. Instead of the father falling, you have the son falling instead.
Yes.
Right?
And so what's still wrong with the story, right? It's telling us that the myth isn't quite there yet, that the lessons haven't been learned and the family trauma is still continuing, you know, and Mandalorian wearing the armor. And we've already talked about in previous episodes how he's got some parallels to Vader. There is some stuff going on there. So it's really interesting.
Yeah.
I'm so happy that you caught that. Oh my God.
Yeah, I think it, you know, it probably
I rubbed on off
me.
On you?
Yeah, I think a little bit. Yeah, yeah. You know, because we had put the groundwork down for as Mando as Vader or a version of Vader and you know, talking about Attack of the Clones.
I feel like it's like his redeemed self he's wandering around.
Yeah.
You know, like
absolutely.
It's redeemed mind, like Vader, and like he has no name, and like, you know, it's like he's this ghostly spirit trying to nurture a small child. Maybe that child is Ben Solo in a way.
Oh, Ben, interesting. Yeah, I don't know. I was thinking about just, you know, like in Twin Suns, you've got like Maul finding his redemption, you know, in the underworld of the desert and things like that. Yeah.
Yeah, like, and, oh, I don't know. Well, I hope to have some answers by the end of the season, but it's interesting things to pose. Yeah. So we learn, we go on, and again, we talk about the do back and the trick to do with the do back. And it's kind of neat to see, you know, a full do back on screen that we've never really seen, like a moving one, like a good one, other than like the extended editions. And they still kind of looked a little weird. Fennec Shan was awesome.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And they figure out how to sneak up to her. And I loved the plan. And so like they're like, we're gonna wait till dark and then we'll have a plan. And then he's like Turo like tries to sneak up to him and like is like, I'm a cool hotshot. What did you think of that scene where like Mando's sleeping?
Oh yeah, yeah. He thinks that the Mando has fallen asleep on the job, right?
Yeah.
And so he's like, yeah, he's sort of doing the sort of swagger with the blaster, mm-hmm. like he's gonna, you know, maybe if not hurt him, at least, you know, kind of like threaten him and
well, he's
kinda
just gonna like get the drop on him and it.
Yeah.
Like that father-son relationship thing.
Oh, yeah.
Like my son does this to my husband all the time is he'll try to like surprise him or like, you know, like jump on him first thing in the morning before he's like really awake. Like he does that to me too, but it's not as successful. I'm like, oh, you want food or not? But like he tries to surprise me, like he'll hide behind doors and stuff like that. Like that's a very young kid thing to do, and Toro is almost fulfilling that within the story.
Yeah, you get Anakin as this very arrogant, you know, young, naive figure in Attack of the Clones saying, like, I'm really ahead of him and, you know, I can beat Master Yoda in lightsaber fights any day. And then, you know, Yoda on the other side of that coin in The Last Jedi, Yoda says, you know, we are what they grow beyond. So in some ways, Yoda's like, yeah, that punk kid, Anakin Skywalker. I mean, you know, he had a point, even though he ultimately, took the wrong path.
In the end, the lesson that Yoda learned is that, like, the point is to have the people that we mentor, our children, you know, the people that we care about, even that we share love with, to grow beyond us, to become better than us. Like, that's the point of existing with others, is that you want others to surpass you, that you help, because then, you know, part of that is you too.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Yeah. So we move on to, like, their plan, and part of their plan is to shine light in the darkness. How symbolic is that?
Yeah. Blinded by the light, or
blinded
whatever.
Blinded by the light.
Exactly.
Exactly. And it comes in later, which is going to be so interesting to talk about. But Fennec is kind of like tricked, and the young kid is like, I'm going to fight you. And Mandalorian's like, haha, I'm old and wily, and you fell for the trick of sending the young kid in. Haha.
Yeah.
But unfortunately, one of their speeders was busted, and that's why they have to, like, go back for the do back. Mando is like, go back for the do back, young kid. And there's still this, like, lack of trust from this young kid, even though Mando has done nothing but to, like, be by his word, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like, he breaks the tracker originally, and he's like, I've got all the codes. He doesn't really trust him to, like, you know, fulfill his word.
Mm-hmm.
He's kind of already primed with the mistrust situation. Yeah. And so Mando's like, yeah, sure, I'll go get the dewback. You watch her. You can't leave. Don't you realize I couldn't have left? Like, you know, like, maybe you haven't learned. And Fennec, much in our trickster, in our tempter, and in the devil in the desert, the ultimate trickster, works on Toro.
Mm-hmm.
And just as the sun is rising, and it's the red sun of Tatooine, which is significant from a important thing perspective, and I'll go into that as well about the twin suns and stuff like that. This is a full conversation about selflessness and selfishness. And if you've ever listened to Dave Filoni talk about how George talks about the Force, about the morality in Star Wars, or even listen to George talk about it, he talks about this. Yeah. Fundamentally, Star Wars is about a conversation about whether you are being selfish, right? You're self-serving, greed, you want to possess things that you fear to lose, or if you're being selfless, which is that you're trying to interconnect and help others, you're trying to be compassionate, and you're trying to basically honor your commitment, and in a philosophical way, like, what we owe to one another of how we exist in society. So the conversation plays out that Fennec starts to work on him, like, oh, you could have all this money, and, you know, you're being an idiot, like, all of the Beskar on him, and also, you know, he left Nevarro, which we found out the name of the planet. Like, how George to actually tell us the name of the planet when we've never learned the name of the planet before?
Yep. Yep. Just comes up.
That was the bounty hunter planet. Like, suddenly George Lucas tells us, like, literally we need him to, like, write every second episode so we actually learn names of things.
Yeah.
In dialogue.
What's Werner Herzog's name? I guess he's just Werner Herzog.
Yeah, we don't know. The client. It's like, okay. But yeah, so she's working on him. And I wrote this, like, the final line down. You want to be a bounty hunter. Make the best deal for yourself and survive. Ooh, hello. What does he decide to do? He agrees with her. He, you know, helps her up. She's like, undo my cuffs. And she's like, no, no, no. He basically shoots her in the stomach.
Mm-hmm.
I was shocked. I was like, whoa.
Yep.
This is the bad choice that Anakin made. with, mm-hmm. you know, the conversation with Palpatine. He kills the woman he was originally after in an effort to gain the power of the old man.
Yeah, it's that interesting.
It's that like weird triangle shaped relationship all over again.
Yeah, and there's this idea too in Star Wars, right, that you know, comes up like in the Art of the Force Awakens book, or you know, various when you get people like George Lucas or Phil Shostak or you know, Rick Carter talking about what Star Wars means, there's this idea too that you know, we're trying to get to the spirit and away from the sort of like the grubby, like money, you know, the rat race, you know, capitalist existence, right? Like, I mean, you know, George was like a multi-billionaire and stuff, but that, you know, it's not about being a bounty hunter living on your own and making a ton of money, you know, the way the Mando kind of appeared to be in the beginning of the series, right? It's like, mm-hmm. it's about, you know, working cooperatively and like the whole trust thing that you're getting as is pretty key, right? Because Mandalorian's kind of sticking his neck out for this kid and risking his life to, in like sort of an implied sense, he's sort of saving this kid's life, or he would have been, he would have been in the context of, you know, the two of them teaming up to, you know, kill.
And the agreement they have between them is like mutually beneficial. Shand is a bad person, right? Mm-hmm. The guild lives by a set of code of honor rules. They bring in bad people, generally speaking. Obviously, mm-hmm. the child, the asset, is like an exception to that. Mm-hmm. You know, they do work for the highest bidder, but they still have like a code associated with them. And this agreement was going to be mutually beneficial. He was going to get the money. The other guy was going to get the reputation. You know, it was going to be good for both of them. And as soon as this temptation happens and he seeks power and money and greed and like, especially that reputation, like that pride, mm-hmm. the pride associated with it, like he's afraid of not being respected. It was fascinating to see play out actually on screen and like see that happen. And mm-hmm. I can see a lot of people not getting that. It's just very George Lucas. I don't know what else to say to you. It's weird.
And now we know that George was very heavily invested in the original live action Star Wars TV series that never came to pass, which is called mm-hmm. Star Wars Underworld, was one of the code names for it, you know, widely known now. And in the first episode of The Mandalorian, he asks, you know, Greef Karga, he says, is it, you know, Underworld ? And it's not really, it's more mm-hmm. of like an Imperial remnant kind of faction with you know, Werner Herzog and the Stormtroopers and Dr. Pershing. And with you know, Shand, we really get, you know, Underworld both literally and figuratively, right? We get mm-hmm. the desert stuff that you brought up, as well as, you know, the sort of Underworld kind of Crimson Dawn, mm-hmm. you know, sort of figure, Black Sun type of figure.
Like an assassin / mercenary. Like she's a person you send to go and kill people. Like,
yeah,
it was really, really interesting. I do want to talk a little bit about Twin Sons of Tatooine, which is mm-hmm. like a very key metaphor. You'll notice kind of in the Rise of Skywalker lead up, Rey and Kylo are being associated with the Twin Sons of Tatooine. There mm-hmm. was a red sun and a bright kind of white blue sun. Mm-hmm. It's very purposeful when they choose to include them, when they choose to not include them, and when they choose to say only show one of them. And yeah. in this episode, they only showed the dark sun rising. Mm-hmm. That was purposeful. Dave Filoni would never forget that there's twin suns on Tatooine.
Mm-hmm.
To anyone who thinks that that's like a thing.
yeah, of course.
Everything in this episode was very symbolic, and that was one of them. That was one of the things, is that there's like a red-orange sun. And the red-orange sun represents, like, if you were thinking of two halves of the same thing, or intertwined, you know, ever-encircling suns, it's the darker sun. It is the dark side. It is the darkness, but yet still important from a yin-yang perspective of the balance.
Mm-hmm.
And I just, like, I want people to be patient with the storytelling sometimes. Like, yeah, you don't necessarily need all the answers all the time right away. And this episode was just absolutely fascinating to me.
Yeah, you sent me that still, and in the background you can see the twin lights, like maybe two sets of them even. Where,
yeah, there's two sets of them, yeah.
One is sort of the color of,
we
like,
talked about
the
it
legacy
last episode,
saber.
The red,
yeah.
The red lights.
Yeah. Yeah, the eyes of Palpatine, but also in this case, like, one of them is sort of the color of the legacy blade, right?
Yeah, it's blue and red.
Now, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think that in A New Hope, when Luke is in the garage, for lack of a better term, given C-3PO the oil bath, and there's the Skyhopper in there, there are lights behind him that are, I believe, the same exact colors, and you see those lights again in Attack of the Clones when Anakin and Padme are again in that garage having the, you know, talk. And
I think you're right.
Colors.
Yeah, same colors.
Same colors.
So there's something special about Tatooine and mm-hmm. the binary colors and not being overwhelmed by red. I don't know. Nothing that is done in Star Wars is not on purpose.
Yeah.
It is either gut feeling that it should be this way, which ends up becoming purposeful, or purposeful, and mm-hmm. especially symbolism, especially color theory, especially to do with choosing to go to Tatooine. Why would you go back to Tatooine in a show called The Mandalorian, except mm-hmm. to give George Lucas a chance to write an episode about Tatooine?
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know. It's the thing about
so
the
weird.
Binary suns, you know, like, the thing about the binary suns is interesting because, you know, Lucas and Campbell and people would say that, you know, we, all of us has like a dualism to us, mm-hmm. right? We're all kind of that Janus figure or whatever, where we've got like sort of the, you know.
Campbell would say that we as humans, because we live mm-hmm. in time, we live mm-hmm. in a temporal reality, split yeah. things into binaries. Go watch The Power of Myth and Symbolism. He explains it very, very well. So
yes.
because we exist in time, we turn things into good versus evil, light versus dark, before.
Past and future.
Past yeah. and future, right? When we become transcendent and understand that we are not separate from the whole, we understand that there is a third way. And mm-hmm. that is the mask of God. That is the way of us understanding the balance of ourselves.
And in a Star Wars fan kind of sense, right, you have these sort of, you have different kinds of Star Wars fans a lot of the time who, you know, I really, you know, I don't really groove with the prequels, or, you know, Rogue One isn't my thing, you know, but in the sort of big picture sense, it's really healthy to kind of embrace all those different parts and kind of like learn from the different stuff that you like. And I'm not using myself there, because I grew up with the prequels and I love the prequels to death. But, you know, you have these sort of factions within the Star Wars fandom and the yeah. audience that understands different parts of them to be my Star Wars. And George Lucas would be like, you know, get out of town. You know, this is all kind of one
all
machine.
Star Wars. And this, the overall message, like, to your point, Alex, I'm saying your name because I'm George Lucas. to your point, Alex, is that we have to honor the past to move forward. And those that don't necessarily honor the past
yeah.
are like doomed to make the same mistakes.
Yeah.
And even in the end, the Mandalorian uses his light to defeat the bad guy.
Yeah.
He uses light. And Pelle is like, maybe you're smarter than you look.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's so symbolic.
And gosh, like in the prequels in the original trilogy, you know, they would talk about the dark side, and they would talk about the Force, and they would talk about doing the right thing. But Luke would use language like the good side. And it's really only the sequel trilogy, the Disney era, I think, and correct me if I'm wrong, mm-hmm. but that we started to hear Leia Organa say, there's still light in him. I know it. Kylo saying, mm-hmm. you know, I feel the call to the light. You know, I don't recall that terminology being used a lot outside of maybe like, you know, novelizations and things like that, like the sort of ancillary material back in the day. You know, in the films themselves, you know, it was how do I know the good side from the bad? And mm-hmm. it was sort of like you had like neutrality, and then you had like temptation and, you know, Faustian, you know, the whole Vader thing, right? The whole bargain with the devil.
Like, I want to say being in the middle is not the gray. Being in the middle is accepting all parts of yourself and trying to connect with others in the most compassionate way you possibly can. Being that transcendent being is to understand the good and the bad and to try to do good.
Like, yeah.
I do want to say that, like, because sometimes this stuff is very confusing to wrap your head around. George, did you write this episode?
Yeah. Call us, George. Email us. Add us on Twitter.
This is the most George Lucas piece of material that has come out during the Disney era. And if you didn't like it, I can understand maybe why, because it was so prequels. It was bizarre. But I think it was trying to remind you that you gotta love all of Star Wars. Even if you don't love all of Star Wars, you gotta at least understand that it's all part of Star Wars.
Yeah. Which is a good thing to kind of think about. You know, Disney Plus launched, what, like a month ago, less than a month ago. And we've got all the pieces of the puzzle kind of laid out side by side, you know, at our fingertips, or most of them anyway. We got to wait for like Solo and Last Jedi and stuff. But but I mean, it's kind of, you got all these different sort of prisms through which to see the story, right? You know. Resistance and Rogue One and Revenge of the Sith, you know, those things can feel kind of different from one another. The Mandalorian feels different from those, but they're dealing with like the same basic like ideas, right? Of like hope and, you know, giving of yourself rather than just taking and wanting and, you know, but each piece kind of adding something new. And like with the Mandalorian, of course, you've got this whole parental figure dynamic with the baby, right?
Yeah, it's like if Anakin could have raised Luke.
It really,
that was so good.
I'm glad that I said that and you didn't say, well, what the hell are you talking about? That's not right at all. But no, yeah, it feels that way. It feels like you've got that sort of hothead kid who was both Anakin and Luke. I mean, even in, like, if you read the comics of, like, Anakin and Obi-Wan sort of pre-Attack of the Clones, you know, Anakin didn't join the Jedi Order and just sort of, you know, become Obi-Wan Kenobi 2.0. It was, you know, he was still that kind of hot-headed, rebellious kid with the troubled past and stuff. And, you know, I think you see sort of the Mandalorian echoed in Toro the same way you see Vader and Anakin echoed in Luke, and on into, you know, Ezra Bridger. And like, you know, there is an echo, you know, that happens, you know, Rey, you know, we see Anakin Skywalker, you know, 9-year-old Jake Lloyd Anakin in Rey. We see Luke in Rey, you know, I mean, there is a sort of,
And we see Anakin and Rey, like we see, it's almost like the repetitive story of this sort of character too, right? Mm-hmm. Like, how many times do we go through this character? Yeah.
The nobody from the Modesto, right?
Who exactly.
Dreams of bigger things. And
yeah, exactly. We are all George Lucas.
Yeah.
Let's talk briefly about the figure that appears at the end to rescue our mercenary Fennec Shand from most likely death.
Yeah.
She doesn't die because she is rescued by somebody, most likely. And it is not Boba Fett.
Yeah. Everybody seems
there's
to
no
like
way
the
it's
trades.
Boba Fett.
Yeah.
There's no way.
I want to say I hope not, but you know, I don't know. They would have to get pretty. They'd have to justify that pretty strongly. And yeah, I just don't feel
like it's necessary because they're specifically trying to tell the Mandalorian story. And I think if they brought in Boba Fett, it would confuse a lot of people. I think it's the bad guy.
Moff Gideon.
Yeah, I think it's going to be Moff Gideon. It's going to give him some way to bring her back to go and hunt. Like, you want revenge for what happened to you or something cool like that. And then she's going to go after him. Yeah, I don't know.
We know he wears like a black cape. So
yeah, he's got a cape. He wears armor that's very similar to the Mandalorians. He's literally going to be like the opposite of the Mandalorian, I think, from a like an appearance perspective, and he fulfills that dark, you know, thing.
Yeah, I think he wears sort of like the armor that like the snowtroopers wear in like The Empire Strikes Back, but like black instead of white, that kind of
Well, and he had like a metal shoulder in one of the pictures I saw. So to me, I think that's going to be him.
Yeah.
I don't
know. That's
fair. I don't think it's going to be Boba Fett. I just don't think they're going to do that.
Yeah.
I have no good reason other than I think it's not a good idea from a story perspective.
Yeah. I mean, because in so many ways, the Mando is a reinvention of the, you know, what Boba Fett was sort of conceptualized as with like the holiday special and, you know, like.
We don't need two Boba Fett.
Yeah, we don't. Yeah, we don't need like the old and the new.
Yeah. I do think that, you know, kind of at the end, we got to see Pele and she had learned something about herself by the end because of the child and, you know, sent the Mandalorian on his way. He overpaid for the services, which is a very Western thing, too.
Yeah.
You know, that was kind of like a little like hint, nod, wink. And she's like, well, go bring him off and dump him in Beggar's Canyon. Hello, yeah. Callback. How many callbacks? Like, crazy callbacks, like Easter eggs. I'm sure people who love Easter eggs were freaking out about this episode, and I love it for them.
Yeah,
but it was so George.
it felt like A New Hope with, you know, kind of like a more like laid back, confident, like self-assured voice.
Yeah,
you know, that A New Hope might lack, because, you know, a 30-something year old with having a nervous breakdown made it, you know, as opposed to, you know, George is a little bit more comfortable with who he is by now, I'm sure.
But it absolutely did not feel like Dave Filoni's writing, who wrote some of the most complex and beautiful character, you know, stories in Star Wars Rebels. So yeah.
When I think Filoni, I think of Rebels, and it's a very different kind of
feel. Yeah. Yeah, so take that home with you, put it in your pocket. I hope you enjoyed that speculation that George Lucas ghost wrote this episode, or it was some sort of epic homage to George Lucas's style. The next episode, episode 6, will premiere on Friday, December 13th, and is directed by Rick Famuyiwa. He did direct episode 2, and it says, "The Mandalorian joins a crew of mercenaries on a dangerous mission. Who is babysitting Baby Yoda during this period of time?" Again, I guess we'll find out. I think this is the episode with the actor who played Tonks, Natalia Tena. We know she's in it, and she's playing like a Twi'lek like bounty hunter.
Oh, okay.
So I think this is going to be the episode with it. And then we get into the crazy period of time where we have an episode on Wednesday and then the finale on like the Friday after Tross. So it's going to be a little bit hectic. We'll try to do these episodes as soon as we can and get them out. But yeah, I'm looking forward to this next little adventure and road of trials with a crew. So what's really interesting about this is that our Mandalorian has learned how to work with others. He's learned from his past mistakes upon his road of trials, and he keeps on improving.
Yeah. There's this whole family thing happening, right, with the tribe and just that the idea that he's been accepted once more by like his brothers and sisters in the tribe, you know. Which we haven't seen them for a while. So interesting. But yeah, he's integrating with that whole idea of being part of the society, right? Working together with others, even if others take the Toro route and, you know.
Maybe aren't successful at also doing the same thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I look forward to next week's episode. And Alex, thanks for joining me for episode 5. This was a lot of fun.
Yeah, thanks so much.
And where can people find you online if they are looking for you?
Twitter at Alex J. Kane, K-A-N-E, or various websites like, you know, StarWars.com or Polygon, places like that.
Awesome. Do we have a line from this episode? Oh, I guess the repetitive, like, self-referential one.
Yeah.
We can bring you in warm or I can bring in cold. It's your choice.
Yeah.
All right. Take care.
Thanks so much.
Thank you for listening to What the Force. I'm Marie-Claire Gould, your host. Our music is orchestral music composed by Christy Carew for What the Force. We have a Patreon at patreon.com/whattheforce. We like to thank all our patrons, especially those who love and are obsessed with What the Force: Melody, Night Huntress, In Wild Space, Susan, Jessica, Cassandra Corvid, Brad, Black-Eyed Lily, Anna Perez, Raylo Musings, and Jawa Dog. Make sure to like and subscribe on YouTube or leave a 5-star review on iTunes or any of your other pod apps. It helps people find the show. You can connect with us on Twitter at What the Force Show, at What the Force Podcast on Facebook, or on our website, whattheforce.ca. Feel free to reach out and start a conversation. Cheers.